Editing Life. This is Dr. Herbert L. Barley, Dean of the University of Healing here in Campo, California, bringing you instant inspiration. Editing Life. I'm in the process of editing our books in preparation for republishing in them and getting out fresh copies because we're down to the bottom. We've run off thousands and thousands and thousands of them for our students, and now we're ready for a rerun. And with the rerun, it's time that we do a little bit of freshening up. And we've been talking about God. And I keep looking in the dictionary for the name God. And every time I look in the dictionary for the name God, it just gives a lowercase G-O-D. And it says God is not capitalized. God is only capitalized when it's talking about a particular deity. Mm-hmm. The deity of the Catholics, the deity of the Protestants, the deity of the Muslims, the deity of the Hindus, the deities of whomever. But unless it is a deity, it is not capitalized. The universal, all-encompassing God is not capitalized. Even in the Christian Science report that they give, they talk about principle being capitalized, but God is not. How interesting. The thing is, it's like saying, how do you capitalize the wind? Or as Ellen would so joyfully say, how do you catch a moonbeam in your hand, you know? How's that song go? So, from The Sound of Music, how do you catch a moonbeam in your hand? Maria. Now, how do you catch God in your hand? How do you catch a breeze? How do you catch a drop of rain? How do you catch the essence of the universe? It's just not catchable. It's so everywhere and everything. It is, it's touchable, but it's not touchable. You can touch it, but you don't know what you touched. Have you touched a raindrop? What happened when you touched a raindrop? It instantly became you. You and the raindrop were one. Mm. And you touch a snowflake, and it melts right down the tip of your nose. And you think, my goodness, isn't that beautiful? And I was looking at the snowflake as it came down, and I had watched this design, because I've got very good eyes, you know. And so I saw the snowflake and all its intricacies, and it landed on my nose and went, bloop, and went back to its nothingness. And I thought, all that work, all that design, planning, all that creation to make the perfect snowflake in all of its many wonderful forms, and then, bloop, it just disappears. And think of you, Dodie here. Dodie, who's come down here from the Midwest. Dodie would go in her backyard, and she would take out the snow shovel, and she'd shovel the snow from her front walk. You never did that? You never shoveled snow from your front walk? Well, you missed a lot of fun.
I loved it.
You missed a lot of fun. Who did the snow shoveling at your house? Nobody. Don't think about it too long. The thing is,
we had the city do it.
But we lived in the city too, Wauwatosa, and we still had piles of snow. There were years we had 5 or 6 feet of snow. Hmm. It was a pretty good snow, and you were 10 years before me, so you probably had even more snow on the ground, and you were from Lake Michigan too, and the snow is big around there. But anyhow, think of it, Dodie. Think of it. One shovel of snow has over 1 million snowflakes in it, maybe 1 billion. Yeah. Because every little tiny snowflake is no bigger than the tip of your finger, and it's as thin as can be. Yeah. And it's piled on top of piles and piles and piles, and they're all stuck together. It's amazing. I mean, God is so frivolous to create snowflakes for no purpose but to melt on your nose, you know? Or on your glasses. Yeah. Well, when you're editing our work here, it is kind of fun. Because every time I edit it, I see a different way of approaching the same thing to tell the story to our students. And I don't want to make it too different, because then we have to rewrite all the essays. But basically, it's the same. And it tells the story beautifully. But when I see God in the dictionary, as I always have, being lowercase, I think, who am I to put God in uppercase? What God am I speaking about? Am I talking about the God of the Hindus? Am I talking about the God of the Christians? Am I talking about the God of whom? And I'm not talking about anybody's God. I'm talking about everybody's God. The universal presence. And we want to capitalize universal. Well, how can you capitalize universal? The book. In the dictionary, universal itself is not capitalized. The source is not capitalized. All these things are capitalized only when people like Mary Baker Eddy come along and they say God is principle, and principle is capitalized. And other people who are philosophers and geniuses of various ilks, they come along and give the word the source of the universe. You look it up in the thesaurus and look it up under the word deity. And then as you look it up under the word deity, you will find dozens of capitalized words that have been used to represent God and to try to limit God. And of course, there's no way to limit God. There's no way to limit the limitless. And yet we try to do it. But it's kind of fun. And as I'm editing away there, I'm thinking now, this is not really what I want to put across here. It's not really what I want to say. But it was what I wanted to say at that time, because it opened the doorway for a lot of people who moved from where they were to where they were going. But in this day and age, this is not the day how many years ago in 75 when this came out? And that's 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. And in 30 years, the advancement of society in its thinking capacity has made great strides. Not like in ancient times, where 200 years go by and 2,000 years go by before something really takes effect. But today, because of our computers and because of many other things, boom, 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 this stuff happens so fast. So if I say to somebody, excuse me, we were in Ghana and Nigeria, and I walked around those two beautiful nations saying blithely, I'm God, God I am, I'm God, God I am, and you're God, God I am, and everything's God. And he says, yeah, so what? Obviously, that's true. I mean, here they are, not threatened by all of the Madison Avenue boys and all of that sort of thing. And they said, of course, they don't care. They know that. They knew that before we even wrote the book. They knew that before the dictionary even came out and lowercased it. They knew that all along. And that's a wonderful thing. But you see, you have to go around the world and experience this. You have to go to countries that are from a different philosophy, from a different attitude of life. And as you go to these countries from different attitudes and different ways of thinking, you find that, hey, their thinking is advanced, far more than ours. Far more than, we think we're so up to date and so terrific, and we don't even know beans. We don't even know beans. You know, I was reading about the Border Patrol, and the Border Patrol hires all of the sophisticated instruments to detect drugs that people bring across the border. And that's as it should be. Not really. I'm just going to now deny that. And they miss it. They miss it. These sophisticated instruments just do not pick it up. And so they get out their dogs, and they teach their dogs to sniff drugs. And the dogs sniff. But sometimes there are other more predominant smells, and this takes the dog sniffer away from the drugs. But what they have found is that they can take some of the old-timers, the old Border Patrolmen, who've been through the ranks, and they move them back from their desktops, their desk offices, out into the field when they have great need, you know, when there's a great demand. And these old bucks, they can smell it with their thought. They see a car going through, just a minute, pull over there. Boys, check that out. Pull over there. Check it out. And the most unlikely suspects, most unlikely cars or trucks or whatever going through, and then other ones you think, well, surely they'd check those. They don't. They know intuitively where the drugs are. They know intuitively where these things are. And I mean, they're the boys who are sitting in the office. They're the boys who are up front. They're not on the scene. And they have that intuitiveness built into them because they haven't learned to depend on machinery. They haven't learned to depend on electronic devices to give them this information. They have always had to do it from their inner self, their intuitive self. And they're wonderful. They're wonderful. They had pictures in the San Diego papers and several other papers about the Border Patrol in Texas and the Border Patrol in New Mexico and the Border Patrol in California here, how the old-timers, not the old-timers really, it's the executives, the chief executives who've been moved upstairs, you know, in the Border Patrol hierarchy, were brought out into the field under a very demanding thing right after the 9/11 thing, and they checked and they checked. They knew what was going on. They sensed what was going on. They had an intuitive awareness of it. Now, this is what you should be teaching, if you can, to the new Border Patrol men. Not just teaching this electronic stuff and all that sort of thing. I'm sure that has value too. But this intuitive awareness is something that does not lie. It cannot be faded away by having some other scent that's there, because it transcends scent. It transcends the obvious and reaches into, if you will, the inobvious, to a deeper sense of intuitive awareness, and it's wonderful. I don't know whether the people writing those articles realized what a significant thing they were saying, but they surely did say something very significant. They said something really powerful. Now, that's just that area. Mm-hmm. But now, I read people's writing. I intuitively listen to the writing as they're writing it. And all of a sudden, boing, it hits me. They're saying something totally different than their words are saying. And so I look for this something totally different. And I say, ah, so these people have a depth that is not apparent on the surface because they're writing in such simple words. And it's magic, really amazing. And then I give a lecture. And as I give a lecture, I intuitively listen to the audience. I always have and always will. I listen to the audience. I listen to what their needs are. And I may have prepared a beautiful lecture. Fabulous! Any lecture I can prepare is fabulous, of course, you know. But I prepared a beautiful lecture. And I'm ready to give my talk. I'm all fired up for it. And then I listen to the audience. I take a few minutes while I'm being introduced or while they were warming up, and I listen here and I listen there, and I say, hey, my talk is not suitable for this group right now. They're in another frame of reference. They need another direction of thinking. And so, shazam, out it comes. And illustrations and ideas and concepts and a powerhouse. People say, wow, you must have spent a lot of time preparing that talk. That just hit home with me, and that hit home with them, and it hit home. I said, I didn't have a chance to spend any time with that. That was instantaneous. That was inspirational. That was momentarily, and that was the best kind to give. Now, this is what I'd like to see you do, Inga. I'd like to see you get excited about your subject and talk about your subject, not just be erudite and take down all this beautiful information which you have, but you have a way of saying things, and you have a beautiful vocabulary. You have a beautiful heart. Ever stop thinking about that? You have a beautiful heart, and your heart wants to be expressed in your talk. At least I would like to see it more often, because you oftentimes cover up your heart by the fact that you want to tie yourself down to having it pre-written, you know. A lot of people try to write their talks ahead of time, and they kill them. Because you don't know what the audience is going to do. You don't know what thoughts going to come up in your mind about trees, about the things that you're doing. You know, you have no idea. You're talking, and all of a sudden, boom, there comes a thought that you never dreamed about. And the time was there to say it, and the time was there to do it. So think about these things and plan these things and work on these things, because you're a genius and you're wonderful, and all of us are. And editing life should be editing live. EDITINGLIVE and editing LIFE. We edit life live. So, join with me, and next time we'll have another wonderful adventure in editing life. I love you.